We'll have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It's 1:31 in the afternoon of Monday, January 30th, 2012, and we have a quorum to conduct business. Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski is here, Senator Pasquin, Senator Coghill, myself, Senator French. 4 out of 5 is pretty good, and we hope Senator McGuire will join us. I'm sure she will, or is trying. And we have two matters before us today, SB 168, Geographic COLA for Judges, SB 173, the Revisor's Bill. Let's start with SB 168. We have a representative here from the court system who got a big promotion since we saw him last. Let's stop and congratulate Mr. Wolliver. Congratulations. Nice to see you here. Put yourself on the record. You know the routine.
My name is Doug Wolliver. I am now the Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. I'm sure one of these days I'll just say Administrative Attorney, but Deputy Administrative Director.
Still very fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing Senate Bill 168. This bill was introduced by the Senate Rules Committee by request of the Alaska Supreme Court, and it looks to update our geographic differential statutes as they apply to judges. Under current law, employees in the executive and judicial branches receive a geographic differential on their salary that helps offset the cost of living in the communities where they live. Each community essentially has a different rate. Several of them share a rate, but each community has a rate that estimates the cost of living in those communities, and then that rate is applied to the employee's salaries. The exception is judges. The rules are different for judges. For judges, there are two restrictions. One is, regardless of the actual cost of living adjustment or cost of living in each community, a judge is limited to 17.5%. Although you'll notice in that sheet that I've distributed, the cost of living in some of these communities under the recent union contracts is as high as 60%. Additionally, the judges only get that geographic differential on the first $40,000 of their salary. So the most a judge can get is 17.5% of $40,000, which is a $7,000 geographic cost of living. In many of these same communities, other state employees are having a geographic cost of living in excess of $30,000. Legislatures approved geographic cost of living differentials out of recognition that the cost of living in many rural areas of the state is staggeringly high. The whole point of the cost of living differential is that if you live and work in rural Alaska and you work for the state of Alaska, they adjust your salary so your adjusted salary makes your income somewhat commensurate with those in the urban areas. The legislature has been doing this for a very long time, and they've been doing it for almost all state employees for a very long time. The first geographic differential bill passed the legislature and was enacted in 1966. High cost of living affects all other state employees, it affects judges as well. Right now, judges in rural Alaska are disadvantaged as compared to judges in urban Alaska because that cost of living is so high. Legislature has made this adjustment through the geographic cost of living for all other state employees, and we would like the legislature to make that adjustment for judges as well. Not only is this just an act of fairness, but as you may know, finding judges for vacancies in rural Alaska can be a challenge. This has particularly been a problem in Bethel. We've had judicial counsel has struggled to find enough applicants for both Superior Court vacancies and District Court vacancies in Bethel. Not only our current vacancy, they've had to go out for a second round because they didn't get enough qualified applicants to fill our current vacancy, but the last time we had the same problem, and the time before that we had the same problem. The same with the District Court. Now, there's no guarantee that adjusting the cost of living is going to solve that problem, but it is one thing we can do. And looking forward, we know that in Nome, a year from now, Judge Ben Esch will be retiring from the bench. He will have served in Nome for 17 years, and we need to fill that position. In Barrow, Judge Mike Jeffrey has been on the bench since 1982. He's the longest-serving Superior Court judge in our state's history. We will have a vacancy in Barrow coming up in the beginning of 2014. One of the reasons we would like to push for this bill is we do want as many qualified applicants as we can get. This is no guarantee that this will have a significant impact. It may not. But it is one thing we can do that we know addresses a problem that we know exists. As we discussed just before the committee started, this bill, the geographic differential, is not applied to judicial retirement. Judicial retirement, the bill states, and this is existing law, judicial retirement is computed only on the monthly base salary, not including the geographic cost of living adjustment. This is in current law. We're not looking to change that law. What we are looking to change is the geographic differential so that rural court judges are not disadvantaged simply because they live and work in rural Alaska. And I also passed out to you a colored, I say colored because we're quite proud of the fact that it's colored. We only have one color printer in Juneau that shows you the various cost of living adjustments, how many judges are in each community, what they get now, what their base salary is, what their geographic differential is currently, what it would be under both the statutory differential, which is what the non-covereds in the executive branch receive, and then what it would be under the currently just recently renegotiated union contracts. But it gives you an idea of kind of what other employees get in terms of a differential and what judges as a percentage of their current salary. You know, in the second judicial district, it's less than 4% of their salary, whereas in Kotzebue under the union contract, it's 60%. We're not looking for that. We would like to tie judges' geographic differential to the statutory provisions that apply to, say, all the attorneys that appear before them. And then whenever that statute changed, it would apply to judges as well. Happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Wolver. And the record should reflect that Senator McGuire joined us many minutes ago. Welcome, Senator McGuire. Everyone, I think this may be the place where I'm going to start asking my questions regarding this chart. And let me just walk across the column so I understand what they mean. The first column tells me where the judge serves. The second column gives me their base salary. The third column tells me what the current statute geographic differential is, up to the maximum of 17.5.
Yes, and it doesn't say, but that's limited to 40,000, the first 40,000.
17.5 of the first 40, and then the fourth column, the yellow column, tells me what that amounts to in dollars. And as you mentioned during your testimony, the maximum is $7,000. So in Barrow, for example, you get the maximum 17.5% geographic differential, yields a $7,000 bump to the salary of $181,000. So the fifth column, non-covered geo-diff applicable, explain what that means again.
Those would be non-union employees in the executive branch, and they are governed by the statute that is referenced in the bill.
So, and they are currently getting whatever the geographic differential works out to be.
Yes.
Applied to their entire salary.
Yes, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
And then the fifth, the green one, non-covered geo-diff. Oh, that is if you took that same percentage and applied it to the judge's salary, that's the amount that the differential would be, the increase.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And this is what the bill envisions, is adding to each judge's salary what's in column number six, the green column.
Yes.
And then the last two, remind me what they are, columns 7 and 8.
Mr. Chairman, the last two reflect the most recently negotiated union contracts, and they probably most accurately reflect the current thinking on the cost of living in these various communities.
I see. So you could see, if that thinking were incorporated into the judges' salaries, you'd see even larger jump. Using Barrow, continuing on the Barrow example, if we pass the bill, the Barrow judge's salary would be adjusted by 36.9%. But chances are it might go up to 50% in a year or two, given the new union contract.
Mr. Chairman, it would go up whenever the statute was changed. This statute has not, as you probably know, been changed in a number of years.
And one other question I have on this subject, which is we pay our judges a lot. I understand the fairness argument. You know, you shouldn't sacrifice income to go to Barrow or to Bethel. Because it's going to cost you more to live there. Do you is it possible that judges' salaries have gotten bigger increases in the last few years to compensate for the fact that they don't get good, strong geographic differentials?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you know, judges do get a good salary. The thing is that under this current scheme, it's a whole lot better deal if you live in Anchorage. And that's what this bill tries to address, to say, regardless of where you live, judges are going to come out about the same. And that's the goal. But they certainly do get a good salary.
I will leave the questions about getting more women judges on the bench to Senator McGuire, because I don't want to steal her thunder. And I can just sense it's coming. I mean, I'm just going to give a premonition. But do you, and just for the record, I think you may have said this in your testimony, but just for the record, do you notice you get stronger applicant pools for Anchorage judgeships than those in Barrow and in Bethel?
Mr. Chairman, almost always. Which we probably always will. That's where most of the lawyers live. That's where most of their families are. Moving to rural Alaska isn't for everybody. So we will probably always get strong pools of applicants in our large urban centers. We just don't want this to be another barrier to getting strong pools in the rural areas.
And my last point will be, I get the fairness argument, but there's a certain amount of sticker shock when you look and see what the total amount is. Going back to Barrow, we'd pass this bill. I guess you should subtract the current $7,000 that they're getting to get the difference. That is, you're not going to go. Is it $66,000 on top of what they're getting now, or is that going to be on top of their base salary?
Mr. Chairman, on top of their base salary.
Okay, so it's a $59,000 raise, not a $66,000 raise. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr.
Okay, very good. Those are my questions. Other questions? Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, same argument. I just look at it, and, I mean, you certainly want to pay people. It's certainly understandable. People live in higher-cost communities. You want to pay them more. $90,000 more in some of the communities, $108,000 more. I'm guessing that's more than twice what the average family out there earns. So I think when you pay people in Barrow, for instance, to live in out there, you want to pay them. It's got, well, actually, I don't even know if it's got that much higher heating costs. They've got natural gas there. But, I mean, the food's more expensive. The fuel's more expensive. I just don't know if it's $90,000 more expensive. It just seems there's a bit of sticker shock there for me.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it is high. It's not the 90. It's in the green column. But your point is, I mean, it's 66,988 is a lot of money as well. I get that.
And just for the record, then I'll turn to Senator McGuire. How do you calculate geographic differentials? So who is responsible for coming up with a number?
Mr. Chairman, the number in the green column is in statute. It's been there for many years. It was a study done a long time ago.
Well, now, just for the record, you said in the green column. I think you mean in the what I'll call the number five column. The green column is the dollar difference.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Yes, yes. The number in the five column, the white column, starts with 15.2%.
Right.
That's set in statute. Legislature passed it a number of years ago. I don't believe it's been amended for a long time.
Did we pick these numbers, or did we turn to the Department of Labor or some other agency to develop the differentials?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know. I think that the last time this amended was before I started coming down.
So these geographical differentials don't float with, you know, people aren't going to do an annual survey to figure out what the geographic pay differential is. We put them in statute, and we've left them alone.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there was a study conducted, I think, in 2008 by the McDowell Group. The legislature has not adopted those in statute, but I think, and I could be wrong here, I believe that's part of the negotiation process for the union contracts. So they rely on information like that to try to make their contracts reflect current costs of living.
Sure. Just while we're talking about things, the difference between Kotzebue, which, you know, the statute says 36.9, and now the union contract is given a 60% differential, that's enormous. And last question, and I'll let other committee members jump in. The history of this, how did the legislature ever pick 17.5% of 40,000 is the max we're going to give judges. Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, in the committee minutes at the time, which were not, I mean, they're not all that detailed, but at the time, this was 1978 when they adopted this, the thinking was $40,000 is about what your actual cost of living, that portion of your salary where cost of living is effective. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea where the 17.5% came when they adopted the statute for others that wasn't limited to 17.5%. So I'm not sure beyond what one statement in the minutes where they said that they think this was $40,000 reflects how much you spend on living.
Senator Passman.
Has there been an analysis of what $40,000 would be in 2012 dollars?
In 2011 dollars, it would be $73,000.
So then if we were to apply the thinking that they thought then, it would be 17.5% as the top on
$73,000,
if we were to just follow that logic.
Through the chair, Senator Pascal, that's correct. And that's what I looked up this summer. 2012 may be a little different, but that's what it was earlier this year.
Senator McGuire.
Oh, great. And through the chair. So I just wanted to get an update on recruitment. And I know the governor's done a better job, at least over the interim, of selecting female candidates. But I just wanted to hear an update on efforts to get more women on the bench from you. What efforts have been made in terms of outreach? And and then also, if I missed it, just a little bit about how information came back to you that there were candidates that were discouraged from applying for these judgeships in rural areas. In other words, there will be, you've got probably your biggest group of potential fans right here. It's only going to get more difficult as you go out of the store here, and I think you understand that, because people will say, what about teachers? Mm-hmm. What about firemen? What about, you know, they'll go through the list of folks in our state that are working in rural areas and who they might believe deserve higher compensation. I happen to support the bill. I do think there is a certain amount of sticker shock associated with it. So to be able to defend it, I'd like to hear, are there any studies that have come back, any through the Judicial Council, any reports from lawyers themselves that say, you know, I was actually considering doing this, but it simply isn't enough money to live, or, you know, those kinds of things. What data did you use?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, admittedly, it's anecdotal.
Okay.
It's frustration by our sitting judges at the cost of living compared to what they would be making in Anchorage, and it's just anecdotal where a judge will say, so-and-so was thinking about it, but it just isn't worth it. As you know, a lot of depends where you come from on your path to the bench, but if you come from a successful private practice,
right,
it can be a big reduction in salary. And for those people, they're not doing it for the money anyway, but it just doesn't seem fair that to work in rural Alaska, you pay a premium.
Yeah.
But it is anecdotal. As far as selecting more women to the bench, you probably were pleased to know that the Dillingham Superior Court position was filled by the local public defender, who was a woman. And interestingly, she was getting 27.5% geographic differential, which was about $30,000. She'll now get, I think, $7,000 in geographic differential. Her salary, of course, goes up.
Yeah.
But the differential goes way down. I know that this past summer, there was a bench and bar program that Justice Babe helped put on. Part of the focus was attracting more women to the bench. So, but it, as you well know, it's a long struggle. It is better than it used to be, at least in terms of getting applicants and getting names sent to the governors. So, you know, I think I distributed, it's been last year that Larry Cohn, the Judicial Council's work on looking at, you know, what percentage of women are in the bar, what percentage apply, what percentage of those who apply for judgeship, their names are forwarded on, and it all does look pretty good through that process.
Thank you. And just in wrap up on that, if you, serving as the liaison back and forth between our two branches of government, thank you to Justice Fave. I'm sure I'll see her at some point, but thank you for that. And any further efforts that can be made to that end, One of the things that I pointed out, have pointed out to female lawyers in conversations, is that it's not unlike running for office, that women, in my conversations with women in national organizations, women tend to have to be called or tapped to the office. They tend not to be people that run out and say, pick me, pick me. It's a very different, again, we're speaking in stereotypes about gender, but it's a different culture. And similarly, I've spoken with many women who I think would be excellent judges and qualified, but they somehow feel that similar calling. Like somebody would ask me if they thought I'd do a good job, and they don't seem to have that willingness to put their name forward and to be judged by their peers in that same way. And so it's a cultural challenge. So I bring a thank you and a request, please, particularly in Anchorage, for more outreach and more efforts, because as I pointed out, in the area of domestic law in particular, and family law, what's coming back to me over and over again is the fact that you do get that opportunity for a bump on either side. And if you do make that bump and your client is a female, you end up, and if that female believes, let's say she's been in a domestic violence circumstance at the hands of a man, and believes that she would have a more friendly audience in a courtroom with a female, she does not have that opportunity in my state. And I think that that's a travesty, because I know too many really great women lawyers. So I just say thank you, but let's beef up our efforts.
Senator McCast, pass me.
In column number two, the base salary, how much has that base salary increased from the same period of time that the $40,000 was set? And then I would like to know what the comparison of Alaska's average wage, or you know, some other average wage in Alaska from that same period of time is, so that we get a relative to the larger population.
Through the chair, Senator Pascavano, I can try to track that information down.
Let me make a suggestion. Neil Freed.
That guy seems to know everything.
One of the most actually, there's one of the more recognized. I mean, just for you know, parenthetically, I've been he and I were on a Klondike running race team one time, and we drove from Anchorage out to Whitehorse, and we stopped at gas stations along the way, and you know, four of us would walk in, and everyone would go, "I know you," and they all point to Neil. You know, me, you know, chopped liver, nothing. You know, it was they had seen his face for 10 years on the TV, and he's just a recognizable guy, great guy, and a great resource. Senator Coghill.
How do magistrates fit into this picture?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, magistrates are in the PERS system, and they are like all other employees. They get the full geographic differential on their full salary. It's only appointed judges who do not.
But, Mr. Chairman, where do they start at salary-wise, base case?
There are four different levels of magistrates. I don't have their salaries right now in front of me, but I can get those.
That would be nice to know.
It's a good question. Thank you, Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, please continue.
Also, you know, any sympathy that I have for this kind of gets diminished when I think I've been a kind of an advocate and a critic of my Office of Children's Service people who spend days in and days out before the judges, who do a lot of the footwork, and they're usually around the range 15 to 18. And they literally run themselves to death, and their GeoDiff hardly gets them even to the cutoff point of this. So, I mean, it's just very something I have to keep in mind when I'm going forward.
It's I think you can sense the whole committee's feeling that. Senator Passman.
What is the difference in retirement system between a magistrate and a district court, superior court, or appellate court judge? Well, or if you're a new hire in 2012.
Well, the magistrates are part of the new magistrates would be part of the defined contribution plan. Judges, as you know, are part of the judicial retirement system, which is a pension system. It's 5% per year up to 10% per year up to a maximum of 15 years. So 75% of a sitting judge's salary is what judges get, and then most of our magistrates are, like most state employees, still part of the PERS system, Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, or now Tier 4.
I don't want to increase the envy of judges here anymore, but I'm friends with a retired judge, and he smiles broadly when he discusses his retirement.
Mr. Chairman, I can appreciate that. However, maybe you can corroborate this. It's my understanding they can be called upon out of retirement to take caseloads. Is that discretionary, or is that something that is required of them?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's discretionary on both the part of the judge who chooses to remain eligible to serve pro tem, they call it, and then on the court to select them. A lot of our retired judges do serve pro tem, and we rely on them a great deal. A handful don't, but a lot of retired judges continue to serve kind of part time.
And I think that was the reason for doing it, trying to draw pro tem work in. Mm-hmm. And great respect for those who take up on it, and I lose my respect when they don't.
Yeah. What's the compensation for a pro tem, a retired judge who's pro teming? Is retirement plus, or is it pro tem salary separate, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, pro tem judges get a dollar amount per day. I believe it's about $500. I'm not positive about that. But they're capped. If they work enough, in addition to if they're eligible to draw retirement, we have pro tem judges who are not drawing retirement yet. But once they're drawing retirement, their combined pro tem pay with their retirement pay cannot exceed a sitting judge's salary. So you can't retire and then end up making more money by doing pro tem work.
Further questions? Senator Passman.
I believe I was reading an article, condolence to the family. There was a judge in Kodiak that I think was repairing a frozen pipe or something.
Sitka.
Yes.
Magistrate.
Bruce Horton. Yeah. Yes.
Good story, but yeah.
Yeah, just conveying that to the court system that was a loss will be remembered.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no, seemed like a real community leader. A lot of he was a training magistrate. Other people looked at him for leadership and guidance.
Yeah, and he was a magistrate there for many years. And it is. It's, you know, ever been up in your in your attic, you can step through the joists and down you go. It's not hard to do.
Right. Yeah, no, sad story. Well covered by APRN, but very sad story. Nice family, whole thing. I think that looks like you've exhausted the questions of the committee. You've got some follow-up. So we will set this bill aside, get the answers to the questions, and bring it back up soon. I know it's a priority for the court system, and I think we're sympathetic. We're just, like a lot of folks, want to make sure we've done our homework on this before we send it on.
Thank you, Mr.
So thank you. Let's turn now to Senate Bill 173, the Revisor's Bill. We have Ms. Kurtz here, who's the Revisor of Statutes. And it's an awfully slim revisor's bill. I'm not sure if this is due to the stellar work you did last year or who gets the credit, but I think it's one of the smallest revisor's bill I've seen in some time.
Well, my name is Catherine Kurtz, and I'm actually still the assistant revisor of statutes, and so this is a great time to mention that my boss, Pam Finley, will be coming by with a special revisor's bill, which has at least four more sections. So
we got a CS we can look forward to.
Yeah, well, that's a different bill. It's all about posting notices at post offices, which the post office doesn't permit anymore, but we require it in several places. So because there are
Two revisors bill this year?
Yeah, two revisors bills. This is the general revisors bill,
okay,
where we're just making suggestions for improvement of the statutes, as we do every year, conflicts, deficiencies, and obsolete provisions. This year's bill is short, and it's long on fixes to obsolescence problems. So just zooming through the sections, I know you've all read the sectional, I'm sure. Sections 1 and 2 get rid of obsolete date references where it says thou shalt do something prior to 1973. Well, it's long past, so we're pulling those. Section 3 gets rid of a reference to federal territorial law, which they pulled out of the federal statutes a long time ago, so I think this should keep track. And if anybody knows why that's not the case, please let me know. I'm just not sure why it hasn't been pulled out before this. Section 4 is about the Harbor Facility Grant Program, and that was a governor's bill, and it amended the sections necessary to do what they were doing, but it didn't change the name of the fund, so it's still called a municipal Harbor Facility Grant Program, and really it's not just municipalities, so this updates the name of the fund.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just go back to Section 3?
Sure.
And it says the governor may not adopt or may adopt necessary regulations for them not inconsistent with 48 U.S.C. 473-479. What is in that 48 U.S.C. 473-479?
Well, it's actually gone. Right now it's a blank line that says omitted in the U.S.C. And what was there, 473 established the Alaska Militia. Pardon me for reading. 474 exempted from the militia service all persons exempted by the laws of the United States, judges of the territory. It's 475 established the National Guard, the Alaska National Guard. It's all territorial law relating to the territory. So I guess my rationale in removing that is that it's not on the books anymore. If people look at that site, they will go find nothing unless they really do their research to delve into historic federal law. This goes on to say that they're subject to all federal laws and regulations relating to the National Guard and the militia. And it looks to me like the rest of it covers it and, you know, go conform to current federal law. So I'm not sure that reference in adopting regulations not inconsistent with the law that's essentially gone away at the federal level, I'm not sure that's helpful anymore. Does that clarify?
Thank you.
Just while we're on that point, as a stylistic matter, do you think the legal profession is now ready to say in the year 2012, instead of saying not inconsistent, just say consistent? Or do we think those are still two different ideas?
I like the idea of consistent much better. Now show me where it.
No. It was just a stray thought. You know,
yeah.
I mean, not inconsistent is a phrase we've all come across 1,000 times, and I just wonder, you know, I mean, if we were writing the statute today, would we just go ahead and say consistent with?
Ideally, and you might break it up differently. So, because the may is permissive, and the idea of consistency is, I think, mandatory here. So the governor may adopt necessary regulations, and the regulations shall be consistent with federal law.
Mm. Wouldn't that be a nice way to say it?
That would be lovely.
Sure. We're working towards it. Okay. We got through Section 4, I think, and you were on Section 5. I see we're inserting a new date that may someday we have to pull out again. I'm on page 4, line 5.
Yes. That's exactly right. I think the effective date of this subsection is not helpful at all, and a date that we will have to eventually take out is helpful in the meantime, and yes, eventually that date will be obsolete as well. And maybe the whole statute will be, in which case maybe the whole statute should get looked at that point. But it's an improvement for now.
For the time being, it's still operative.
Yeah.
Section 6.
Okay, Sections 5 through 5 and 6 are related, and actually 5 through 12 all deal with the same problem, which is that of a definition being repealed but still being referred to someplace.
Mm.
So in 5 and 6, the repeal that's affecting subsection 5 hasn't happened yet, but it will. It's up there on line 1 on page 4.
Right, 42-45-045.
Yeah, that's going to go away in 2013.
Right.
That whole section, that definition. So section 6 takes the definition that's currently there in 42-45-045 and inserts it in a new subsection where the term is being used here, so that your definition won't sunset when
it's the existing definition now just put in a new statute.
Correct. So now we're going to have the definition is going to appear in two places, same definition.
One sunsets, one doesn't.
Exactly. So it's anticipating what's going to happen when the sunset. And true, sometimes sunsets get pushed further down the road, but
does happen.
I would suggest that this get dealt with now while it's on the radar, because it's obviously problematic if we look at 7 through 12 if the definition actually goes away, which in this case is definition of school district, and it's being referred to in several places, in several different sections that relate to tax exemptions or tax credits, rather. So there we've put the definition in, again, using the same text, in Title 43, so now it's closer to all those references, and it's back in. It's been missing for a while. Okay. So that's 7 through 12. Section 13 was a suggestion from Deborah Barrett, the Department of Law. She pointed out that all departments now have the capacity to notify the legislature electronically, and so that they don't need this fallback provision about what if they don't.
Oh, I see. Yeah, on page 6, lines 5 and 6.
Yeah. And 5 through 11, it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then finally, section 14, which doesn't look like much in the bill, is kind of a leftover. It's a provision that provides for the renewal of a two-year license in insurance. And the thing is that the provisions permitting this two-year license all got repealed in 2004. So even if there were licenses out there after 2004, and there probably were for a couple of years, they should all be gone now. So that cleans up that.
Great. More questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Section 7, mm-hmm. you school district used to have the meaning given in AS 1403-126. I see that section has been repealed, 1403-126. Is that the same definition that was in 1403-1?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? I don't see any. We will sit on this. It is it's just a remarkably easy revisers bill. I just I have to say it again. I'm used to them being sort of long slogs, and it's kind of nice. So without any further questions, thanks so much for being here. We'll ponder this for a day or so, and then I'm sure it'll move right along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that all of you have big, bulky binders on your desk in front of you.
Big, bulky binders. Well, some of us are dual capabilities. Some of us are, we look at our iPads from time to time and hold them and look at them sort of mysteriously.
And today's my first day completely paperless.
And how did it go?
It went great.
Yeah.
It was not a problem at all. In fact, my staff, Sam, set it up for me, and if you have any questions, happy to help you do that.
Awesome.
We'll send Sam around.
Very cool.
Great. Anything else to come before the committee? If not, we'll make it a short day and adjourn.
Okay.